simply read that for you as Yahweh, because the translators let us know by that device that we do encounter the divine name, God's name, Yahweh, in the Hebrew text. Today we're going to cover an unprecedented 6 verses today, Lord willing. And so Proverbs 22 is where we are. And we're going to look at verses 22 through 27. So do read along as I read out loud in your copy of the scriptures. That is, do read along in your copy of the scriptures as I read aloud in mine. Proverbs 22, verses 22 through 27. Do not rob the poor because he is poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate. For Yahweh will plead their cause and plunder the soul of those who plunder them. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. Do not be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge, one of those who is surety for debt. If you have nothing to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? These 6 verses are 3 couplets of verses, and at this point in Proverbs, we're going to, at least for a couple chapters or more, not see the one-verse topics anymore. You're going to see, two verses talking about the same thing. That is, the Proverbs are a little longer. Sometimes you will have 6 or 7 verses now, since we've hit this point, talking about the same thing, same topic. But we have 3 topics here under 6 verses, 2 verses for each of these topics. So there's a little bit of a transition in the book of Hebrews now. Let's look at the first of these topics in the first 2 of our verses, verses 22 and 23. Do not rob the poor because he is poor, but nor oppress the afflicted at the gate. For Yahweh will plead their cause and plunder the soul of those who plunder them. Now with this, what we might call a couplet, we're going to look at more of the Hebrew than with the others, because there's more that's new to us here. Do not rob the poor. Our Hebrew word here for rob is gazal, and it means, according to Strong, to pluck off, specifically to flay, strip, or rob. According to Osborne, to snatch away or injure. And according to Wilson, the longest of the 3, to pluck off or away, to tear away, to take by force, especially of the rich and powerful, who seize upon the possessions of the poor by fraud and violence. So, it is the word that does mean to rob, but it's kind of like a violent robbing. You say, is there ever a robbing that isn't violent? Maybe not. Maybe that's a good word to translate it with here in English. If you think of stealing, you can steal something, right? You steal something in a clandestine manner. Nobody even knows it's missing. You can do it under cover of night, or if it's in a big store, not to teach you how to steal, but it's in a big store that when it's Christmas and there's tons of people around and so much activity and they don't see you, you can do that and there isn't really any physical violence or any oppression that is involved in it. But to rob, as in distinction to steal, robbing is, in English, robbing is stealing that has violence associated with it. And so, this is the Hebrew word. It's a good word to translate rob here, because as Wilson particularly points out to us, that something that is the word of choice that's often used for, in other Hebrew, for the rich and how they rob the poor in a very violent way. Some of the other ways that this is translated talk about like a violence, pluck off, strip, flay, tear away, snatch away, injure. And so you have those words that speak about the violence that's associated with this robbing. Do not rob the poor because he is poor. Both times that word poor is there, is thou in Hebrew. We've seen it already many times in Proverbs. It is the normal word for poor. Do not rob the poor because he is poor, nor oppress. The word oppress is the ha. It's a pl intensive. So it's not just to do this thing, but it is to do whatever is going to follow now in these definitions I'm going to give you. It's to do this, to do these things that come in this definition in an intensified fashion. Now, I read to you these definitions that come from our Hebrew scholar brethren, you're going to see that it already sounds intense. It already sounds intensified. These are words that you sort of can't do any other way but with some intensity to them. Strong translates or gives us in definition to crumble. Transitively, and that's the way it's used here. You remember what the difference is between a transitive and an intransitive verb? I don't think I ever learned that when I was... I never remember hearing that in all of my days of mandatory education. I learned what a transitive and an intransitive verb was when I had to teach my own children English when I homeschooled for a couple of years. But transitively, as we find it here, Strong says that it means to bruise. Now, can you bruise someone and it's not really intense? You know, if you come up to me and you say, good message, and you slap me on the back, it's probably not going to bruise me. To bruise me, you're going to have to really put some power into it as you hit me on my back. And so, it's like to be able to bruise, I don't really understand some of you bruise easier than others, but to bruise, if you've inflicted something so that it brings about a bruising, there's a certain intensity that's already there. But that's strong. Wilson, to break in pieces, to crush. Can you, not intensely, can you just sort of, you know, passively crush something? You see what I'm saying? So you have to take these definitions and then just add to that even more. That's what the Hebrew is talking about. Osborne says to beat small, break, trample on. Okay, so do not rob the poor because he is poor. Nor oppress, and that's our word, the afflicted at the gate. Afflicted is ani. We've seen this before in our studies of the Lord Jesus Christ, particularly in Proverbs, I believe. White and unger speak about this word this way, and this will make sense to you because of what we just said. This noun is frequently used in synonymous parallelism. Hey, synonymous parallelism. Okay? What is that? That's when you have two lines, and they're talking about the same thing, right? What we see in Hebrew poetry all the time. We haven't spoken about that for a while in Hebrew. In Proverbs, but here it is in synonymous parallelism with ebayon, which means needy, or with thou, and that's the word that we saw twice already in our verse, which he translates poor. It differs from both in emphasizing some kind of disability or distress. So the afflicted one, he has some disadvantage. That disadvantage brings him into his vulnerable situation, and it's easy to make him even more disabled. Now, because of his situation, his disability. And then this is all taking place in the gate. Don't do this, particularly the second part of our verse. Oppressing the afflicted at the gate. Okay. Now I can put those down for a little bit. When we talk about at the gate is the place in the historical, cultural setting that Proverbs is written in, where decisions of legal matters would take place. We see it in the Bible, right? Maybe the most famous one is Ruth. When Boaz wants to acquire Ruth as his wife, and he goes and meets with the elders at the gate, and there's a man there who is not necessarily one of the elders, but he got this man and brought him to the gate and said, the right of redemption is yours to buy the field of Elimelech, since he has died, and his two sons, the two heirs, Mahlon and Chilion, have died as well. So right now this is the field, they call it the field of Naomi. And do you want to buy this field? And the man says, yes, I will buy it. And he said, then he had, he hurried to add this. On the day that you acquire the field from Naomi, from the hand of Naomi, the field of Elimelech, you will also have to take Ruth, the Moabitess, who is the wife of the deceased, one of the sons, so that you can raise up seed to your brother. Do you still want to redeem this? And I'm giving you sort of a paraphrased version of this, but it's close. And he says, no, lest I injure my own inheritance. And so this transaction goes on. These witnesses at the gate ratify the fact that this legal transaction, this transference of property, as well as the right to marry this woman, is sealed now in the legal fashion. Job talked about it when he talked about, if I raise my hand against the poor, when I saw that I had support in the gate, then let my, and I you never remember how he said this, but the idea is, let something have my arm, let it wither, drop off of its socket or something. This is the instrument that I voted with against the poor to take away his justice. Well, let my hand lose its ability or just drop. And that's taking place at the gate, though. He said, when I saw I had support in the gate. Now, lots of things happened at the gate. Lot sat at the gate of Sodom. He came as a sojourner, and now, as they said, even the men of Sodom, now he's making himself a lord over us. Well, you don't get to sit at the gate by just deciding you want to sit at the gate. I'm sure that they allowed him to sit at the gate until, of course, he did something that they didn't like. But it was at the gate. Now, That's all human, and you all understand that. I did say you all very quickly. It wasn't y'all. And it sounded like it when I said it. And what about when we transfer this, though, to something that isn't human, and we use the same figure? When Jesus said, "Upon this rock I will build my church, I will erect my assembly, and the gate of hell will not prevail against it." What the history of the gates was all about now has that meaning, and Jesus takes that and uses it as a figure of speech to say, the place where hell, and even hell is a figure, it's a place doesn't make decisions, right? It's the people who make those decisions. The constituents that will make up hell, their decisions won't be able to destroy my church. So the plans of Satan through his controlled humans won't be able to destroy my church. You know, we're here, it's Wednesday night, and very few of us are here, all right? In the United States of America, this is happening all over the country. Churches have scheduled Wednesday night meetings, and those Wednesday night meetings are dwindling like gangbusters, like nobody's business. If you just look at what you see in your little world, things look a certain way until you go somewhere else. You could say, boy, I mean, is this of God? And maybe, you know, the gates of hell are prevailing, you know? If you went to other places in the world, and it was likewise a Wednesday night, you would see standing room only, jammed, just packed into places that were teaching the Word of God. This promise, it doesn't matter what it looked like, it doesn't matter if you weren't aware of it before, this promise that the gates of hell will not prevail against His church. I mean, it is just, you don't ever have to worry that the church will ever finally be extinguished on the earth. It will not. It will never be finally extinguished on the earth. If there is another Muslim invasion, and I'm not talking about something as small. It really is small. I'm not talking about something as small, at least even compared to what I'm talking. And I really am talking about as like the Twin Towers thing. That's nothing compared to what I'm talking about. I'm talking about around the 600s, 700s, 800s. As Islam militarily swept across lands that at least were nominally Christian and Islamized them. If that happens, and you see it happen, and that happens on a broad scale, if that were to happen in the United States, it wouldn't make any difference as to what Jesus Christ had said. His church will never be eliminated from the earth. The gates of hell are the councils of the demonic through the demonically controlled. Here, if in our verse, the gate idea, do not rob the poor because he is poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate. In other words, don't add to their affliction. In the gate, that is, in some legal fashion. You could say, it's all legal. You know, okay, we got to give you that. It's all legal. What you did was all legal, but just because it was legal didn't make it godly. Just because it was legal didn't make it holy. Because the legal system today is not, as much as it may claim to be, it isn't justice. So there is a real getting over, if you will, that the wicked can do against the righteous. And some of them, man, some of it's by judges. Oh, we got a judge here that's like, just, he's a fool. I was visiting my mom yesterday and try to find something that's interesting to her on the television. And there's this, you know, these courtroom programs that are so popular anymore today. Every time I watch one, I just think, this person is a judge. If you've seen it, this one happened to be Judge Alex. I think he's the best one out there out of all of them because he at least carries himself with some kind of dignity. As this goes out on the internet now, I have to be careful what I'm saying, but maybe Judge Alex will listen to this, and sure he's tuning into our website regularly and listening to my messages, but maybe at least he will be impressed with what I said. But sometimes it's the judges. Like, we can really do some underhanded things because the judge is a fool. Okay, you wouldn't walk out of there having done your injustice, having oppressed the poor. You can say it's all legal. Just because it's all legal, just because it's in the gate, doesn't mean it was holy. So don't oppress, don't rob. In other words, what you're doing to the poor is you're getting their money somehow in the gate or at the gate. Don't rob the poor because he's poor, like because I can, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate. Many reasons could be given as to why you wouldn't do this, but here's the one that's given here. For Yahweh will plead their cause and plunder the soul of those who plunder them. Now, this is really interesting. The word plead, listen to this now. Listen carefully to these two Hebrew words. The word plead is the Hebrew word reeve. The word cause is the Hebrew word reeve. Same word. Reeve as a noun and reeve as a verb. We've seen this before, many times in Proverbs, and it's usually a word that talks about strife or contention of some kind. Yahweh is going to strive with you if you do this, and he's going to strive their striving. That is, he's going to take up their contention and contend with you somehow. When God contends with you, it's usually not, he doesn't take on some bodily form, Lord Jesus Christ, even here, Old Testament, theophany situation, and come and argue with you face to face. No, he's in control of human affairs. He is sovereign over history. He is the one who moves in his providence. And he'll contend with you in ways that you really don't like and you can't escape. Here's what it says he'll do. He will plunder the soul of those who plunder them. Now, the word plunder is the Hebrew kavah. Kavah, maybe some of you, as I look in the room, I think, who is here when I taught Malachi? And who is not here when I taught Malachi? I don't think of it as being so long ago. But let me show you a place where we encountered this word before in Malachi. You want to turn to Malachi with me to Malachi 3. Malachi 3, verses 8 and 9. Will a man rob God? Oh, this is the favorite verse, right? For all of the television preachers. Yet you have robbed me. Okay, rob and robbed then in verse 8. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? Third time, in tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, this whole nation. All right, four times the word robbed. This word for robbed is this kava. It is, it's like a synonym, because look, we have two words in Hebrew now that we've seen both of them translated as robbed. While it's not the same word in Hebrew, it's the same idea. Watch this idea. I don't know if you picked up on it as we just read it. Go back to Proverbs 22, verse 22. Do not rob the poor. Jump down to 23. For Yahweh will plead their cause and plunder. That's our second word for rob, the soul of those who plunder them. In other words, this is a poetic justice. This is that irony of language and irony of how God works with us, where He says, you rob the poor, I'm going to rob you too. You rob them, I'm going to rob you. I thought about this just yesterday. It was just yesterday. I thought of someone who mistreats someone else and always has a reason why that's not the case. Maybe your kids are like this. You have children like this. One child is always mean to another one, and they always have a reason why it was right for them to do it this way. And I thought to myself, and it wasn't children that I was dealing with, but I thought to myself, I'm going to treat you just the way you treat this person. And we'll see if you like it like that. God is saying, I'm going to treat you just the way you treated the poor here. But I don't need your money and I don't want your money, though He could certainly make you, bring you to nothing. And other Proverbs talk about that He may indeed opt to discipline in that fashion. But here He said, you've robbed the poor of money. I'm going to rob your soul. I'm going to plunder your soul. You have the power. Like, do not rob the poor because he is poor, because you can. I'm going to rob you in a way that only I can. I'm going to plunder your soul, your nefesh, in the Hebrew, which should be translated soul. So there is this poetic justice to either the punishment or discipline of God, as the case would be. Let's go to the second of our topics, our issues today. 24 and 25. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go. Now, in this couplet of verses 24 and 25, we're going to see the same thing happen that we saw in 22 and 23. You're going to be told not to do something in the first of the two verses. And then in the second, there's going to be a reason why. Remember 22, don't rob the poor. Why? Yahweh will plead their cause. Plunder the soul and those who plunder them. Here 24, don't do this. Make no friendship with an angry man. And with a furious man, do not go. Now, friendship. Make no friendship. This is the Hebrew ra'ah. Do many of these Hebrew words sound the same to you? Like, it sounds like I'm saying the same thing all the time. They're very close together. Oh, they do have the same sound. But ra'ah is our word. Now, just out of places where we've seen this in previous studies, I want to show you how it's used here. First go to Proverbs. That's definitely a previous study. If we go backwards, and first look at chapter 10 and verse 21. 10:21, the lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die for lack of wisdom. Now in that verse, what would ra'ah be? Ra'ah is the word for friendship in 22:24. What is that word here? in 10:21. Do you think? The lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die for lack of wisdom. It is the word feed. All right, also in previous studies, 15:14 in Proverbs. Proverbs 15:14. The heart of him who has understanding seeks knowledge, but the mouth of fools feeds on foolishness. Ra'ah is feeds again. Now, from other studies that we've done, I remember exegeting this for you on a Friday night. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. We looked at the Hebrew of this passage before on a Friday night. I actually believe it was at the Scardinas when they used to live in Blairsville. Ecclesiastes 12 and verse 11. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. All right, now the word ra'ah is in there again. What is the word ra'ah, if you had to take a shot at it, if you had to take a guess, in that passage? The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. Well, hold on to your thought, and let's go to Amos. We're in Amos on Friday night, so this one ought to be relatively fresh to you. Amos 1:2. We saw Ra'ah again. Amos 1:2. The words of Amos, who was among the sheep breeders of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. What's the same word in there as in the other? It's worded a little bit differently in those two places, but it's the same word, sheep breeder. Sheep breeder and shepherd in the Ecclesiastes passage. A shepherd is preeminently, before anything else, he is a feeder. He's a ra'ah person. That is, if we take the word ra'ah, it means to feed. And then, if we take and call somebody a shepherd, their chief function is to feed, so he's a feeder. Now, that tells you a lot about what a spiritual shepherd is. Our word, the English word pastor, it just means, it's an old word for shepherd. If you hear about pastoral, I don't know, pastoral something, that means having to do with shepherds and sheep. If you hear it in a non-spiritual context. The majority of my job, so much that it is what names my function, is to feed. Yeah, teachers do that. And so the chief thing that a pastor is to do is to feed. And spiritually that means to teach, to instruct, to explain the scripture so that people have knowledge and understanding. It differs from a mere teacher or an evangelist who is a teacher in that there is also a leadership side to it. But when we have to talk about what is this person, even the name pastor, at least in Hebrew, is all about the other side, teaching. It's the main thing is to teach. All right, but what does that have to do with Proverbs? What does this have to do with our verse? Make no friendship with an angry man. You're saying friendship is, this word feed in two of the things, two of the verses that we looked at, and shepherd in two others. What's the connection? Well, the connection is, this is another big part of being a shepherd. There is a series of thoughts that when strung together makes sense of all three. It is the Hebrew word re'ah, sounds like ra'ah, just a one vowel difference, is the word for friend. Here, not here, here it's ra'ah. The base of what it means to be a shepherd is to be a friend. That's the basic thing about what it means. I should be your friend. And so I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a large church setting, but it's harder to be everyone's friend when you're not 1,000 people, at least in deed and truth. If you're a friend of sheep, you're a shepherd, and so the word shepherd comes from this, and thus, what's the main job of a shepherd? It is to feed. And so, from friend, we go to shepherd, and then we go to feed. And so, make no friendship is a good translation here. Make no friendship with an angry man. Literally, a man of this. Now, the word man is, see if you can get this Hebrew word. You get a lot of exposure to Hebrew, don't you, in these Proverbs and in Amos and wherever else you are in the Old Testament. But particularly in Proverbs, you keep hearing some of the same words all the time, over and over again. You're going to get to know some of them. Like if I said, what's a kasil? You know what it is, right? Well, here, this is the word that is transliterated into the English, even if you never took anything that had to do with Hebrew from me. It's the word, now I'm going to pronounce it like it is in Hebrew. You see if you can make the connection as to what it is in when you read it in the Bible, but it's Baal. Spelled B-A-A-L. That you used to calling it Baal. This is a word, the connotations are horrible, but it's the word for a husband. Because a husband is in authority over a wife. And one who is in authority is a lord or a master. And that's literally what that word, which came to be used as a name for a false god, meant. So when it says in 1 Kings, is it? Yeah, 1 Kings 18, when Israel comes to its senses with the help of Elijah, and they say, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. Well, that's what they were calling the other one, Lord. That's one of the places where you really need to translate Yahweh. Yahweh, He is God. Yahweh, He is God. Because it really, when you translate the Lord is God, Lord is God, that's what Baal means. If you're getting the opposite when you don't translate that name, Yahweh. So it was a standoff between Baal and Yahweh, and Baal lost. Yahweh won, and so they said, Yahweh, as opposed to Baal, He is God. Well, Baal then is a man, but a man like a husband. Oh, man. So this guy's probably old enough to be married. You're talking about a grown man. And he's a man of acts. And that's our word that we've seen so many times before for the last 21 years. I remember bringing this word up on first time in a Job class 21 years ago. It's the word for anger, but it's literally nose. Recall that now? Recall us talking about that? A man of anger, a furious man. A furious man is the same Hebrew as, because we've been there already, Proverbs 15:18. Just very quickly access that. 15:18. A wrathful man. There it is right there. A wrathful desanitish stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger allays contention. Our furious man is same word for wrathful and then same word ish. So ish is in apposition to Baal here. Ish, you'll remember, is not Adam like a human. Ish is the word for an adult male. This adult male who is angry or furious, don't have friendship with this man. What, are you supposed to be mean to him? You're supposed to try to, you're supposed to be his enemy? No, it's not the idea at all. The idea is that when you're friends, you try to, you usually like the person and you spend time with them. They're saying, make no friendship, like, don't associate with an angry man and with a furious man. Do not go. Now, here's the reason. Verse 25, lest you learn. Learn is alaf in Hebrew, to associate with, hence to learn. So don't make friendship or associate with an angry man, because there's a certain kind of learning that's involved in that, that is learning by association. Wilson translates it to learn from the notion of accustoming, training. Lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. Literally, get a snare, not set a snare for your soul. Look at 18:17. How do you get this snare for your soul? We've already covered a long time ago. 18:17. That's not right. Okay. Never mind. You'll get a snare for your soul because you learn his ways. Now, I've tried to talk about this in the past. I wasn't satisfied with how I did it, so I'm going to try to satisfy myself today. How do you learn the ways of an angry man? Let's say that you know someone that fits this category. They are an angry man. If we can call them, if the scripture can call them an angry man, that is, they are a man characterized by anger. They're a man who is, you think of them and you think, what is it if I had to pick one trait that tags their personality? They're angry. It's a person who is, seems to get mad so quickly, like they're already mad, even when they don't look like they're angry. They're already angry. They're just waiting for a reason. Like, give me a reason, and you're going to get this heat. I'm going to blow up at you. Once they get angry, not only are they quick-tempered, but they stay angry. They carry a grudge. They remember things. They will not forget it. I'm thinking of a person in my mind. I mean, oh man, the smallest thing. I remember this thing happened to them. This, oh, if you want to call it a slight or an injustice. I grant you that that wasn't even a big deal. I mean, but you could see how the angry person would take it this way. I heard about this thing replayed for years. This happened to me. They did that to me. And it was the kind of thing like, it's an oversight, man. I mean, anybody can see this. It was not intentional. It was no kind of disrespect meant toward you. It was just that this happened. I knew the situation. It was someone who was overloaded with responsibility, and anybody, including our angry man who is in my mind, should be able to see that this person was absolutely stressed beyond any kind of sense. Like, what would anybody do in this situation? So much stress was there. And so they juggled and they jockeyed and they jostled and they did whatever they could to make the best of a bad situation, an impossible situation. And in the course of that happening, this perceived slight took place to this individual. Well, without trying to just give the person the benefit of the doubt or be compassionate to their situation, no. We're going to remember that for years. And every time that person or that situation or that place where it happened is brought up, we're going to hear the story again. Somebody that just will not let it go. Now, a person who's like that is generally angry about not just one thing. That's what makes them an angry man. You learn the ways of that angry person by association, and you may, at the beginning, you may think that you're not being affected by it because you can see it. You can see that is a reaction that is just way overblown. You're just totally overreacting to that situation. Because you can see that the person is unreasonable, you think that you're unaffected by it, but if you keep associating with the person passively, you begin to adopt some of those ways. Because, you know, angry people have reasonings. They have a rationale. It's skewed way of reasoning, I grant you, but there is a reasoning there. They do have thought, and depending on how angry they are, they can talk about those thoughts for a very long time. If you allow them, they can go on forever just talking about the horrible treatment that they received and why they're justifiably angry with this other person who did that thing. Now, as you listen to that, you may be thinking, oh, brother, you know, you're just spiraling. I mean, you're skyrocketing here, and you may be able to honestly see this is way too much. This is overboard. But some of that reasoning that they communicate makes sense to you. Like, don't you think that anyone would think if a person did this? And you could think, you know, I can see why you'd think that way. As you associate with them day in and day out, since they're an angry man, they get angry all the time. And so another infraction is done against them next week, and you happen to be there. And there's a similar blowout over it, and you get the reasoning, and you tend to get jaded from hearing that against humanity in general. If you have a very meek person, that is a person, if we talk about the biblical idea of meekness, they don't react to situations. They respond in the Holy Spirit, but they don't react in the flesh with negative emotions. And you have this angry man. If the two of them spend time, a lot of time, for a length of time together, I can't see the angry man becoming meek. I can see the meek person becoming angry. Because some of the things that the angry person says make sense. And the meek, or not even so meek, but just not angry person will not even think in those terms. Not even think in that direction. But this skewed perception of everything, this selfish outlook of everything, colors the way they look at all things. And you begin to learn to think that way. And you get a snare for your own soul, because now the kinds of results that come from talking that way that would have been just the receipt of the angry man, there, now you're getting it too. You have received the snare for your soul. All right, let's go to 26. Third topic. Because we've dealt with this so much in the past, I don't have to really spend a lot of time on all the words we've looked at except for one, and the concept definitely in Proverbs, this deep in Proverbs. We've seen this many times. Do not be one of those. Don't be one of those, okay? Before you even read what the rest, don't be one of those. Don't be one of these. Don't be one of those who shakes hands in a pledge. Shakes hands More literally, strike fans, rejoicing in the last row, who strike fans in a pledge. One of those who is surety for debt. Now, debt is a loan. It is masha'ah. We're talking about co-signing again. If you have nothing to pay, why should he take away your bed from under you? Now pay. Oh, man. Are you going to pay? If you do this, are you going to pay? Because you're not just going to pay. Maybe we should translate relinquish. Maybe we should translate, I don't know. But what we've got to do is come up with something stronger than the word pay. Because the word means to pay or to repay most of the time. But it's in a PL intensive form. So I say, man, are you going to pay? You're going to pay in an intensified way. If you have nothing with which to pay, most of us don't have anything with which to pay. Any one of you wants to make a major purchase. You know, if you want to buy, a set of glasses, you've always been admiring this glass on the pulpit. You say, I really like that glass. That's a classy glass. I want that glass. You don't have to co-sign. You can't even do it. It's too small of a purchase if you want a glass like that. If you want a big purchase and you don't have money, maybe it's a car. Maybe it's a home. You don't really have a. You can't buy a home. You get a home by grace. You don't can't buy a home. But a house. You want to buy a house? And let's say you ask me to co-sign. Well, we're going to have to get a third person to co-sign, because if your credit's not good enough, I'm not going to help you. And then we're going to have to get somebody else. But let's say I co-sign for you. If you renege, even let's not make it something bad, renege, that's a bad word. Let's not put it in a negative cast. You just fall upon hard times and you can't pay that anymore. There is no way I'm going to be able to pay for that. Now, if I sign down and sign on and sign off on your debt, then I don't have anything to pay. Why should he take your bed from under you? Now, there's another difference. They don't want my bed if I don't pay. They want my car. They want something big that they can sell. They want my house. Haha, I don't own it. And, you know, they're going to want something. They don't want my bed. Again, we're used to so much more than we actually need, that our culture's actually adjusted to it so that it doesn't even think anything about a bed. We have a bed. I want your bed. They want your big stuff. But at the time that Proverbs was written, oh man, it was, in one sense, this is a much better time. I can at least, okay, I don't have it. You took my big thing, whatever that was. You took my car. But I still have a bed this weekend. Back then, we take it all. We're taking everything. We're taking the monetary value of everything you owe us. Probably, if you had to get somebody to co-sign for it, we take everything you have. It's not going to be enough. So they would absolutely strip a person. But I don't think anybody wants to have their car taken from them either. The idea is that which we've seen so many times, an injunction against suretyship and warning against co-signing. So, I want to take your bed, your mishkav, even, and I looked this up because I wasn't familiar with the Hebrew word for bed here, mishkav, and yep, it's just that extensive. They'll take what you're sleeping on. So, sort of looking back at what we've taught this evening, I exhort you against three things. It's like a negative exhortation. Don't do that. I exhort you against oppression of the poor, association with the angry, and co-signing. He who has ears to hear, let him hear.